I says, Bob must not be in town, huh? He said, no, he's not. I said, I didn't think so. Anyway, I'm really glad to be here. I'm really glad that I really like what Deborah said. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, too. I'm really glad that I'm in AA. You know, I was talking to a guy today, and about 2 months ago, he called me, and I call him every once in a while. And then I started calling him a little more, and he gets real busy at work, and he seems to get disconnected. And one day, he called me, and he got a traffic ticket or something, and he figured he'd fight it, and he went to court. And when he got out of court, the police officer did show up, which they usually don't. And, of course, it was his word against the police officer's word, and you know what happens there. And so he was outside beating an umbrella against a tree, calling the cops dirty names in front of the police station. And I said, well, do you think you should go to a meeting? He said, well, I ain't been to one in a while. He gets too busy and forgets to go, you know. And so he started getting hooked up to AA again, and he was doing really good. And the day I called him, and he told me he bought a... He said he got out of storage because he got a new house, and he got out of storage his brand new $600, record player, and he was going to bring out his albums and listen to them, but the needle was broke. So he decided he'd fix the needle, but he couldn't see very well, so he broke the needle, and he got on the internet and ordered a needle right away, you know, and had one shipped and paid extra to have it done. And when it came, he tried to install it, and the same thing happened. It broke again, so he just took the whole thing and demolished it, you know. And... you know, I understand that kind of behavior, you know. There's a line in the book, it says that our problems pile upon us, ever seeming astonishingly difficult to solve. And, you know, that's not while I'm drinking. That happens if I don't go to meetings or get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get a problem here and a problem there, and pretty soon there's so many of them, I just can't see, you know, to get my way out of it. But I also heard the other day that there was they started a meeting over by Circus, and... but also what happened was there was a cop, he pulled somebody over back there on Industrial, I think it was, right in back of Circus. I guess that's the street back there. And when the police officer pulled him over, he walked over to the car and he asked the guy for his driver's license and registration. And he noticed in the back seat that there was these great big machetes back there. So he got a little afraid and stepped back and grabbed his gun and told the guy to get out of the car and asked him what them machetes were doing. And he says, well, them machetes, he says, he said, I'm a juggler over at Circus. He goes, yeah, sure you are. And he says, no, here, let me show you. So he got out in front of the car, and he started juggling these machetes, you know. And these guys from that AA meeting were leaving, and they were driving by, and the one guy looked over there at that, and he looked at the other guy, and he said, boy, I'm glad I'm not drinking. I don't think I could pass the sobriety test. And you know, I always felt like something was wrong with me even as a kid. I was really different than other kids. I remember my mother one time when I got sober, I went with my mother and I was talking to her to make amends to her, and then I started building a relationship back with her again, and I was talking to her, and she always felt that she made an imperfection with me, and I thought she did. And she always felt like she never did enough for me or did something wrong with me. And so I'm sitting there with her and I'm talking to her, and I says, you know, Mom, that's not true. I says, you raised all five of his kids the same way. She goes, yeah, I did. I says, I've been different than all of them. She says, oh, you always have been. Even as a little kid I was, you know. I mean, I just do off-the-wall stuff. I had a really bad temper. I was crazy. My emotions were always out of whack. I remember one time she made me take a bath, and I didn't want to take a bath, and I sat there and argued with her, and I just was so mad. I think I was about 6 years old, and she finally got me in the bathtub, and I took the bath, and as soon as my feet hit the floor, I ran straight out the doors, just soaking wet, went to the biggest dirt pile I could find and threw dirt all over myself. I'll show you, I'll hurt me, I'll go to bed dirty. Watch. Watch what happens to me. Watch how I hurt myself when you make me do things I don't want to do. And so, you know, I didn't see the rest of my family doing stuff like that, you know. But I remember I just was always like that. I was just really out of sorts all the time. My emotions were always on a jag. And I remember the first time I drank, I mean, I had a friend that I used to hang out with other, live with other families a lot because I really didn't like being at home. But I remember going to their house, and his dad always told us, if you guys want to drink, you got to drink at home. And it was around the holidays, so we said, well, we want to get something to drink. Why don't you go get us a fifth of peppermint schnapps? So we went uptown, he got us a fifth of peppermint schnapps, and my friend drank half, and I drank half, and because it was the holidays, they had all that pastry out, you know. We're drinking peppermint schnapps and eating cinnamon rolls, and boy, I was over that guardrail all night long, man. I was so sick, I just couldn't stand it. And man, when I woke up the next day, I vowed that I would never eat cinnamon rolls again, you know. But I never drank every day after that, and I just never did. I never drank every day after that, and there's a lot of times when I was growing up, I always ran around with people that were 10, 15 years older than me. I mean, when I was 12, 13 years old, I was running around with guys that were 25 and 30, you know, so they could all get booze, and sometimes they'd go to the drive-up windows and get a case of beer in the back seat and a case for the front, and if I was in the front seat, the guys in the back would have to start drinking on the stuff in the front seat because I just didn't drink every day. But then there came a time when I just started drinking every day, but it wasn't at that time in my life. I remember one time my friend and I, we got a fifth of Crown Royal, and he drank half, and I drank half, and we decided we were going to go to the dance, and we were walking across the street to go in the dance, and we were getting really lit up, and I was starting to feel really connected, and these older guys drove by in a car, and they said, hey, come on, get in the car, and I told them what I'd done, you know. They says, really, you drank a half a fifth? I says, yeah. They said, why don't you try some of this? And they reached in the glove box, and they pulled out a pint of Everclear, you know. I never knew what Everclear was. I took a couple big pulls off of that, and they went around the block a few times and dropped me back off at the dance. I walked in the dance and fell right out, you know. And my good friends took me out in the middle of winter and threw me out in the back of a pickup truck and left me there. And then I don't know how I remember getting home, and I remember crawling into the house, and my dad was there, and he hollered at me, but I crawled up the stairs and passed out. And, you know, I came to, and he was standing over me with a rag. He'd been there all night with the water and trying to revive me, and I probably almost died, you know. And it wasn't like I thought, well, I'm not going to try doing that anymore, but I never drank every day after that. But there came a time in my life when I started drinking every day. And I remember there was a guy, he was from Salt Lake back there. He talked about Sugar House. Boy, I'll tell you, when I was growing up, Sugar House Park used to have a lot of good drugs in it. I know that. But I remember I grew up in Wyoming, which is by Salt Lake, and I remember the first time I got in a lot of trouble. You know, I thought, you know, I got to go to detox. So I went down to Salt Lake City, went to County Detox on 21st South and State Street, and we walked in there, and I went in. I told him, you know, I told him what I was doing, and they said, come on in, and I was old enough to drink because at that time you could drink at 18 years old, but I wasn't 21 yet. I'm pretty sure of that. And I went in there, and I was under the impression that when I went in there that it was just a matter of time. If I didn't run around with the guys anymore, if I could just physically get sober, that I would be okay. I mean, in my mind, that made perfect sense to me. So I figured when I went in there, they were going to give me the help that I needed to be able to quit drinking. And I went in there, and they gave me Valium, and I learned how to play pinochle, and I ate a lot. And I thought detox was a great place to be, you know. I thought, man, I really like this detox stuff. This isn't really bad at all, hardly at all, you know. And I got out of there with enthusiasm. Boy, I'm going to make a new leaf on life. You know, they're going to be able to start trusting me again. My father-in-law was a captain of the highway patrol. He's not going to be looking down on me like he does. And next thing I know, I went home for 2 days, and I'm sitting there waiting, and all the Valium wore off. And I thought, I was sitting there with me in my mind, and I thought I was going to die. I thought if I have to live like this, I'd rather die, you know. And I'm getting ready to go up to the bar, and my sister goes, why don't you just try going a couple more days? I said, you don't understand, I can't go a couple more days. I'd rather stick a gun in my mouth. And I went up to the bar, and I started drinking, and I got that ease and comfort, and then I went on another run, and the next thing I know, I got to go back to detox. And it was never really my idea to go to detox. It was everybody else's idea. You know, they always thought that it was a good idea if I would just go get cleaned up. And especially my father-in-law that was captain of the highway patrol and his family, you know, they really wanted me to do that. And I went into detox again, and while I was in detox, I had a brand-new truck, and there was a guy that I met there, and he said he could get some drugs, so I gave him my brand-new truck to do it, and you know, next thing I know, I don't have a truck anymore. I have to call the police to go get it. And, you know, I remember getting out of there, and it was in an impound shop, and we went to go to the impound shop, and after I got out of that detox, and I tried with everything in me not to drink. I walked around for 2 days with a bottle of Maalox. My stomach hurt so bad, I hated it. I felt like I was going to die. every day. And eventually I just couldn't do it anymore. And I started drinking. And eventually she left and she got a divorce. And I'm down at the bar drinking, and this gal shows up. She's underage. She's a runaway from home. She has no money, no place to stay, and nothing but the stuff on her back. That's my kind of gal, you know. Pick her up, move her right into the basement of my mom and dad's house. And then my dad's outside screaming at me about how I keep bringing orphans home. And I keep trying to tell him to quit talking to me that way, you know, that, you know, he embarrasses me in front of my girlfriends. And, you know, I move him in, and my mom says I reminded her of my Uncle Buster. He used to live on a ranch, and he'd leave the ranch to go get supplies and come back with no money, drunk, and two girls, you know, and more mouths to feed. And but I'd move him in, and her and I stayed in that town for a while, and pretty soon we had to leave, and eventually we moved to Salt Lake City, and we started living there, and things went on. And I always tried to work, but the thing about it is, this is such a progressive disease that everything just kept getting worse. I got to a point where it wasn't that I didn't want to work, I just couldn't work anymore. And her and I are trying to make things work, and things are crazy, and the insanity is crazy. And finally, we moved to Ogden, Utah, and we're living there. And then one day, you know, I had a job that her dad got me, and he decided that I needed to get straightened out. So we decided I needed to go to detox again. They come banging on the door, you know, you got to go today. And so I went into detox, and I told the doctor what I needed to detox, and he told me what he was going to give me, so I left. And I'm standing there the next morning, I'm crying. She's standing there with our 2-year-old baby, and she goes, "If you drink or use drugs, we're leaving." I said, well, leave the car, because that's where I'm going right now, you know. And I was never the kind of person that went and took everything away from the house and then came home and acted like everything was okay or left for days at a time. I brought everything home. I brought the parties home. I brought everything there, you know. And so I went out, and I don't know where I went that day, but I came back. And about a week later, she decided she wanted to go to detox. So, you know, she brought the car home late or something, but I'm taking her to detox. And on our way to detox, I'm having a loving discussion with her, going down the highway about 80 miles an hour with both feet on her, trying to shove her out the car door that was open on the other side. And I finally got her to detox in one piece, and I felt really bad for the way I had treated her, so I went and bought some flowers, and I took them to detox to her and figured this ought to just smooth everything right over. Yeah, you know, I know I almost killed you, but you ought to just forget about it now that I brought you the flowers, you know. Can't you see how sincere I am, you know? And so about 2 weeks later, she got out of detox, and she came to the house with her mom and dad, two police officers, and her new boyfriend from detox. And if you'd asked me that day, I would have told you that was the worst day of my life. I'm telling you, man, I thought I was going to die. And I started living in flop houses, and I couldn't do it. I hated it, man. I just couldn't get out of the pain. I don't care how much I drank. I don't care how many drugs I did. I could not get out of the pain. It was relentless. And I just, I really wanted to die most of the time. I shacked up in these flop houses. I went down to about 90, 95 pounds. I used to have them at the night desk sometimes. They'd come up and try to feed me. You know, I'd stay in there for days at a time, and I'd just sleep. And finally, my dad came down. Him and I started living together and got another place to live, and I started to do a little bit better. And then I moved to Denver, and then I come to Las Vegas. And when I got to Las Vegas, I just started going on a lot of runs, and I started doing a lot of things. And I remember my dad told me one day that he had an ATM card, and he was afraid that if anything happened to him, he wanted me to get the money. So he told me what his ATM card number was. Really bad mistake. But I'll never forget the time that I went to steal that ATM card. You know, I crawled through the window of the house that I was living in, like a burglar would, you know. And I still to this day can't figure that out, but I remember the shame that I felt with doing that, you know. And I went in and I stole it, and I just started taking as much as I could out a day, $300-$400, whatever I could get, and I went on a run. And I finally got to the end of the run where I couldn't do anything anymore. I couldn't work. I'd been on Social Security for 5 years. And I just, you know, I'm at the end of the line. I can't hustle anymore. I can't do anything. I'm wore out, and I'm tired, and I don't know what to do. So I decided, you know, I'm going to go to detox. You know, I just am, you know. So I'm down at D Street in Jackson, one of my favorite hangouts. And I got this old blue truck, and pretty soon the police surround me, you know. And after I get out of the car, I say, "Hey, I'm going to detox, man, right now, man, you know." And they said, "Well, your truck's wanted." I said, "Well, what's my truck wanted for?" They said, "I don't know, but it's wanted in Denver." Well, I knew what it was wanted for. Me and this guy hooked up, and what we'd do is we'd run around to these 7-Elevens, and he'd get out and go in there and steal a bunch of lunch meat, and then he'd get in the car. Then we'd go downtown and sell it. Then we'd go get loaded. Then we'd go back and do the 7-Elevens again. We did that for about 2 weeks, every day, all day long, all night long, just on a run, you know. So I knew the truck was wanted for that. My wife said you were the baloney bandits, you know. And anyway, the truck was wanted for stealing baloney, you know. And so I guess they felt like it wasn't a big enough crime, so they let me go to the care unit, you know. And since I was on Social Security, I went into the care unit, and I said, will you take me? They said, yeah, we got a bed for you. Oh, yeah, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever it was. They said, we'll take that. Yeah, that's good. We can do that. We got a bed for you. I had $50 in my pocket. Hold that thought. I'll be right back. How can you go to detox with money in your pocket? I mean, that just seems nuts to me. You know, if you got anything to pawn, anything to sell, anything to give away, whatever, don't go to detox yet, you know. So I went out there, and I spent that $50, and I came back. And, you know, then when I get there, I'm thinking, this always would happen to me. I'd get there, and I'd realize, well, why didn't you plan ahead a little bit? You could have had cigarettes and candy. I mean, there was people in detox that had actually planned to go there. They had bathrobes and magazines and candy. I just ain't never gone to detox that way. I've always just gone on a dead run, you know. Then I get into detox, and here's a doctor from AA in there. Out of all the people in the world, I got to run into a doctor from AA. You know, he can't just be a normal doctor. He's got to be a doctor plus an AA. And he said, I'm going to take you off everything. Oh, whoa, now we're getting a little drastic here. We've gone through this scenario before. I says, I understand. I understand I'm smoking crack. I understand I'm drinking. I understand I'm taking handfuls of Valium. And I understand that I've been on antidepressants for 5 years. But my real problem is that damn booze and cocaine. If you can just get me off that, I'll be fine. And that's how I lived my whole life. I always figured if I would just get off of this, or if I just stayed away from it, or if I just do that, I'm always trying to change everything because I keep thinking that I can do it. He said, I'm going to take you off everything. I said, you cannot take me off everything. If you take me off everything, I have seizures. He said, we'll give you something for that. I said, no, you can't do that. So I went back into my old behavior. I'll show you, I'll hurt me. You know, he started giving me medication for seizures, and I would take it and throw it in the garbage. Well, you know, I never been to a place like the care unit before at that time. You know, we're out there doing jumping jacks and playing baseball. I mean, they think we're in spring training or something, you know. I just came off the streets. I'm smoking 2 or 3 packs of cigarettes a day. I weigh about 110 pounds. And you want me to start running around? I'll probably have a heart attack or something, you know. So I'm out there on the basketball court. Next thing I know, I had a grandma seizure, you know. And I'm flopping around, and I came to, and when I came to, they were sticking needles in my arm to test my blood. And, you know, one thing about having a seizure, if you've never had any, I've always had them when I was detoxing. The very first one I had, I woke up in an ambulance. I was driving a dump truck, and I decided I wanted to detox, and I'd gone about 2 or 3 days, and they were loading the truck, thank God, and the next thing I know, I'm in an ambulance. Well, I had a grandma's seizure. They don't like you driving truck after that. And so when I was in there, I knew what seizures were. There's always a moment in time when I get a moment of relief. I would have a seizure, and after the seizure, I'd feel good. And so I didn't really mind them too much, but boy, the people around me sure didn't like them. But, so I'm in there having that seizure, and I got done having it, and I thought, you know what, I don't know what happened after that. I just says, you know what, I'm tired, I'm going to do this. So I went ahead, and I said, okay, I'll take the seizure medication. Then when I was leaving there, they said, you know, you cannot just quit taking antidepressants. They got another doctor in there, some psychiatrist or whatever. He said, we'll give you lithium. I know you've been on a harder, but we'll give you lithium. And so I got out, and I'm taking the seizure medication, and I'm going to a lot of meetings. I'm going to 5 meetings a day. I'm just immersed in Alcoholics Anonymous, just buried. I'm just going to meeting after meeting after meeting. That's all I'm doing. That's all I care about doing. That's all I want to do. I'm just terrified to be left at home with me in my mind. And then people started talking to me about being on medication. You know, everybody's got their opinion, and that's okay, you know. But I don't really know what to do, so I go to my sponsor. I said, what do you think I should do? He says, well, are you a depressed person? I said, well, no, only time I ever been depressed when I was out of money and needed something. That's the only time, you know. Other than that, I'm not a depressed person. He said, well, why don't you go to my family doctor? I said, okay, so I went to his family doctor, and I said, you know, I'm a recovering drug addict and alcoholic, and I'm taking antidepressants, and I'm on seizure medication. I said, what do you think I should do? He says, well, I think you should do is, he says, you can, you can quit taking the seizure medication, but I suggest you keep taking the antidepressants. I said, okay, fine. I'm not even 30 days sober. So I go and I see the doctor that's in AA in an AA meeting, right? And I go up to him and he says, well, he said, it's my opinion. He says, you should keep taking the seizure medication, but quit taking the antidepressants. I'm getting real good advice here. So I went to a nine meeting where Joe Boyle was, big guy, big mustache. A lot of people probably know him here. Kind of intimidating when you're new, you know, that big of a guy. And I went down to that meeting, and I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, I'm going to talk to this guy after the meeting. And I don't know why I did. I walked over to Joe, and I said, Joe, can I talk to you? He says, yeah. Him and Joe and I went outside. I said, Joe, here's what's going on. He said, quit taking it all. 1 minute at a time, 5 minutes at a time, quit taking it. Now, I'm going to tell you, if I was in Joe's position, I don't know if I could give somebody that advice to this day. I really don't. I would find it hard for me to do that. I don't know if I'd have the courage or the smart, I don't know. But I don't know that, I know that he had it. And I tell you, when I went home and I took all that stuff and I flushed it down the toilet, I didn't take any and stick it in the corner just in case I would need it, you know. And then the next morning I woke up like I'd been waking up, like somebody shot me out of a cannon, and I went up to the, and I'm walking up to the Thai club and it's hot outside, and I'm walking up to the Thai club and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm going to die. You know, and I thought, you know what? This little voice came over inside of me. It says, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is either everything or it's really nothing. And if it's really nothing, it don't really matter anyway if you die, because you really don't want to keep going on the way you're going on anyway. I was tired. I was tired of popping pills. I was tired of taking, I was just tired of doing it all. The whole deal I was just tired of. I wanted out, and I'd wanted out for a long time. But, you know, that's the trouble. You know, I've heard people say, well, he's drinking because he wants to. I don't know about that. There's times in my life when I just didn't want to drink anymore, but I couldn't stop doing it. I just couldn't. And I'm going up to the Thai club, and I sit down, and Keith Thomas is there, and he goes, you didn't quit taking that antidepressants, did you? I says, yeah. He says, you're going to go crazy. I'm already crazy. What does it matter? How much more crazier can you get? What, does your head blow off or something after a while? You know, that would be great. That would be new, you know. Let's get something going here, because it feels like it is anyway, you know. And, you know, I've always had a busy mind, so what the hell, a little bit busier, it don't matter, you know. And, I mean, like the other night, you know, I'm sitting there with my wife. She's all into this, you know, reality's right here, right now, try to stay in the now. And I looked at her, and I'm listening to her, you know, because she really tries to do that stuff. And I'm looking at her, and I'm thinking, she goes, you can't do that, can you? I says, no, my mind's too busy. I couldn't stay in the now if I had to, you know. And so I'm going to meetings, and I'm out there, and, you know, and people are well-meaning in AA. They really are. They say things, they sound good, but in reality, they don't seem to, you know, be good, you know. Like, you go to them, and you're not, well, let go and let God. Oh, really? That's how it works? Good. Let him have it all. Just give it all my mind, everything. I'd gladly give it away, you know. I'm tired of it picking on me, you know. And that's like going to a guy that's blind and going, hey, this is the color red, you know. Like he's really going to know, you know. So I'm down at St. Luke's. I'm sitting out on the steps. Joan Elms gives me a bike. I'm riding a bike around, you know, to meetings. That was dangerous in its own right. And I'm barely getting from one meeting to the next. And I'm sitting out there on the church steps, and this lady comes over to me and she goes, getting sober's easy. Staying that way is hard. I said, boy, that's really a nice thing to say. She's got a brand new Cadillac. If I had a brand new Cadillac with an air conditioner, I could drive to meetings and I would get to meetings no problem at all. None at all. I got to drive this old bike to a meeting. And she's talking about it's easy to sober up. And you know what? She was right. She quit going to meetings not too long after that. I think she died sober, but she quit going to meetings. And I didn't realize what she was saying was true, that after a while, yeah, going to meetings is easier on that bike than it is sometimes today with a new car and a house and everything else going on. But, you know, I always made it a point to go to a lot of meetings, stay involved in AA, make AA the center of my life. I've always tried to do that. No matter what goes on in my life, I've tried to do that. You know, when I was new, I didn't really realize until I had got sober for a while. If you're new here, it might be hard to understand why you have to go to meetings over and over and over again. You know I have an allergy to the body. I know that when I take a drink, my body makes me drink more. I know that. There's no doubt in my mind about that. But if that was the only problem I had, when I went to detox, all I had to do was get out of detox when I was physically sober and I'd have been okay. But there was something else wrong with me when I got out of there. And that's the thing that always confused me, was I could never understand, now that I've stayed away from it long enough, now that I'm not around them people, now that I'm supposed to be okay, I want to die. And when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and stayed sober for a while and started listening to people, I started to understand, oh, I know what the problem is. The problem is that. That's the thing that keeps making me go back to drinking over and over again when I don't want to drink anymore, no matter what, because I just can't stand it. You know, I have the kind of personality that if something will change the way I feel, I go to it, and I just can't stop doing it. You know, there are people that look at stuff and go, boy, that don't look very good for me. I don't think I'll do it. I look at something and think, I wonder how many times I can do that before it's going to hurt me. You know, my family will do that. I watch my brothers and sisters. They won't do nothing that looks like it's going to hurt them or it ain't in their best interest, but not me. But I'm going to a lot of meetings, and I'm really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm trying. And I'm about 90 days sober, and I'm down at St. Luke's. And I'm with Joe, and I says, you know what? I got a hole inside of me you could drive a truck through. I said, if this hole don't fill up, I can't stay sober. I just can't. I just can't. I know I can't. I'll stick a gun in my mouth. I'll do something, but I can't live this way. I just can't. I don't have what it takes. You know, I always wanted the kind of person, you know, I've always felt oversensitive. I hurt easy, and I never suffered very well. You know, I always wanted to be like Evel Knievel, you know, where he breaks himself in all these pieces and out the next day he's trying to drive a motorcycle, you know. There ain't enough Demerol in the world to get me to do that, you know. I just can't. I'm a baby when it comes to, I hate pain, man. And they said, well, if you get into the steps, you know, and, you know, when I got my sponsor's car when I first got sober, you know, he says, I says, you want me to write a first step? Because everybody in the carrying unit was writing out a first step. So I figured I'm going to write a first step. I mean, I couldn't write nothing in there. I couldn't even hold a thought. But I'm getting a couple thoughts together, and I want to fit. He looks at me, grabs his glasses, and goes, if you ain't got that, I don't know what to tell you. I thought, oh, that's the truth, huh? And then, you know, I never really understood the third step in a lot of ways, because how do you turn your will and your life over to care of something, and then what happens when you do that? And what's it feel like, and what happens? And you know, I mean, people, you know, I've done third steps with people, and I never felt nothing right away. I don't know what it feels like. And, you know, I never really felt, I don't think I ever really felt it until about 5 years ago. I got diagnosed with prostate cancer. Now, I'm 46 years old at the time. And, you know, the first time I went in, my PSA was high because, you know, people in AA told me to get a physical every year. So when I was new, I just started getting a physical every year. So it was my yearly physical, and I took my physical. My PSA was high. My doctor thought it was okay. You know, wait about 6 months to a year. My wife's a nurse practitioner. No. You got to go get that check now. You know, so I went ahead and went to the urologist, you know, and I went to him, and he said, we got to do a biopsy. They're a blast. Anyway, I got the biopsy done, and it came back negative. No cancer. I said, see, I knew I didn't have cancer. So I'm bebopping along, and about 6 months later, he calls me up on the phone. He says, you have to come in for another biopsy. Whoa, we've already done that. Homie ain't doing that no more. And I argued with him and got in a fight with him and all kind. I had to go back and make amends, you know. I ain't going back in for one of those things. I don't like them things, you know. He said, well, you got to come back in for another one. So I went back in for another one. Well, after they took the other one, I went back and seen my doctor and told him what they were doing. And he says, you know, I don't know why I checked you for a PSA. I don't check people that are 46, usually when they're 50. I thought, boy, the light went on in my head. I said, I got cancer. I know I do. And the results came back that I had cancer, you know. And I thought, well, maybe that's God's way of taking care of me. But anyway, I went back in that doctor's office, and they told me what they could do for me. And I looked up at him, and I says, how long will it take to kill me? And he looked at me, you know, because I'm like that guy that's standing, you know, they say to die an alcoholic death or to live by spiritual principles is not an easy choice. You know, the reason the guy's doing that is because he's thinking to himself, if he goes to jail when he's standing in front of the judge, or he goes to AA, if he goes to jail, he can drink again. If he goes to AA, he's never going to drink again, and he knows that. That's why it's a hard decision for the guy to make, to stand in front of the judge, and the judge gives him AA or jail. Well, I'm standing in front of this doctor, and I'm thinking, no sex or death. I mean, let's face it, when you get sober, there ain't a lot left. I mean, you know, there's some food, and then there's sex. Well, I don't really like eating that much. So, you know, you can't take away everything from me, you know. So I'm standing in front of him thinking, well, I mean, 46, can I be 80, 85, maybe 90? You come to me with this problem, you know. So he says, well, you know, you'll be okay, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, well, I don't think I'm going to be okay with according to you. So I went to an AA meeting a couple days later at a noon meeting that I usually never go to. And I went in there and I'm telling this other guy my problem. And this is why I love AA so much, you know. I mean, there's just so many things to AA. But just one of them is like, I'm sitting there telling this guy my problem and, you know, some other AA member happens to be listening, you know. And then after the meeting, the guy comes over to me and he goes, you know, I went to this doctor down in UCLA. And he said, when I went to the Mayo Clinic, they told me he was the best on the West Coast. Him and another guy. I said, okay. So I got his card and I called the guy up and I made an appointment. I went down to UCLA and the night I seen the doctor here, I didn't sleep all night long. When I went and seen that doctor down there, I slept like a baby that night after talking to him because I knew I was going to be okay there. And I came back from there and somebody called me and from the family and told me that that my mother was on her deathbed. And she had emphysema for a long time, but I'd been talking to her, you know, and I knew she wasn't going to come around. And when I called the sponsor that I have today, I says, what do you think I should do? He says, it's my opinion, you should go down there. I got in my car and I packed it up and I left. I didn't really want to go because I felt like I had made amends to my mother. And so I went down there and I drove down there. When I walked in, I realized she was gone. And I sat there with her the whole time. And then I'd go to a meeting and come back. And, you know, the thing about it is when you're around people that are dysfunctional or crazy anyway, because we were like Comanches when we were growing up anyway, you know. But it isn't like when a crisis happens, everybody gets more mellower, you know. And I would start to get sucked back into that their behavior because I'm part of that family, and I'd go to a meeting. And then I'd get centered again, and I would come back. And right before my mom died, everybody went home, and I went to a meeting. I've never been to a meeting like that before. I went into the meeting, and then you would share, and then everybody would talk to you about what you shared about. It was really weird, you know. But it was what I needed at the time. You know, that's the amazing part is God always gives people in my life when I need them. And I went ahead and went back there, and then my mom passed away. And at that time, I was going, I had another thing going on. I was going out in front of the gaming control board to get a liquor gaming license, which is, that in its own is a lot of anxiety. I mean, I just walk into a courtroom and get anxiety anyway. But I'm going in front of these guys, and I'd been in front of the gaming control board in, I think, around 97. And because I was trying to get the license then, but they had a hard time giving me the license because I just got busted for buying stolen merchandise. And they frown on doing that and giving you a license at the same time, you know. But what happened was is that, you know, this guy, the first time I met this guy, you know, he came into to the where I worked, which was selling liquor, and he came in and he said he was quitting drinking. He was in AA, and I knew he was going to meetings, and I bought a few bottles from him. But then about 3 or 4 years later, like I said, in 97, he came in with big boxes. And I bought them a couple more times. And then the next day, they came with a truckload of cigarettes. And I went, whoa, that's too much for me, man. You know, I don't want to encourage you in anything. And I remember driving home that night, calling my wife on the phone, telling her, you know what? I got a really bad feeling about this. I done something that's really wrong, and I got a really bad feeling about it. Then the guy came up to the thing, and he tried to sell me some more cigarettes again, and this other guy was with him, and I said, I don't know how to get it through you guys' head, but I don't want to buy anything from you anymore. I just don't want to do this no more. And he said, well, that's good, because we're police officers, and they took me to jail, and they arrested me. And, you know, the weird part about it was that I wanted to go to meetings and talk about it, because I don't want to be something in AA that I'm not. I am what I am, and that's just the way it is. And I remember My attorney says, you can't go to meetings and talk about this, because he was in AA too. He says, you got to be quiet about this till it's all over with. Well, the really weird part about it was the next Sunday, I was a spiritual speaker at San Fernando Valley, right? Sunday morning. And I kept thinking, well, I can't go there and talk now, you know. And but I guess if we all waited till we were worthy to say anything in AA, we'd be a pretty quiet place, you know. And so I went ahead down there and went down there and did that, but I went ahead and so all that happened, and I'm going back up in front of gaming control again. Now I got to take my mom to a different town, and everybody's taking her there. Then I got to go get on a plane. I got to fly all the way to Carson City, go in front of gaming control, then fly all the way back. And I went in front of gaming control, and I sat there, and they didn't even ask me to come up and talk to them. They just said, okay, you're approved, and I left. And I went back and I buried my mom, and then when I came back, I realized I had to go get operated on. So I'm driving down there to UCLA, and about halfway down here, I'm thinking, oh, man, what about drugs? I never even thought about that. They're going to give me drugs. How's this going to react on me? You know, I got an allergy. And, you know, and I called a guy in AA down in Atlanta, and he says, what? He says, don't be a cowboy. If you need something for pain, take it, man. Just, you know, you'll be okay. I said, okay, fine. So I got down there, you know, and they gave me a shot to put me under. And I thought, boy, I don't like that anymore like I used to. And I got operated on, and I came out of the operation, and I'm, like, really nauseated. And I said, man, I'm just nauseous. And she says, you want something for sickness? I go, yeah. She says, you want something for pain? I said, I'm not in pain. I just need something for the nauseousness. And then that little old doctor came over to me, and he grabbed my hand, and he says to me, I saved all your nerves. I thought, boy, what a guy, you know. He says, now somebody died in my family and I have to go. And I thought, you know what? He said, I won't be here tomorrow. And I thought, you know, I bet his mom died. Funny how you could feel that and have it all whacked out. But he knew what was important to me. I didn't care if you got the cancer or not. Just save all the nerves. That's what we care about in this situation. Hey, he's done enough of them operations to understand that, you know. And so I went up into the, I finally got to my room, and I got all this anxiety. And I'm in this bed, and I'm like a mummy. They got these little things pumping up on my legs, and they got this little TV, and my mind is going 5 million miles an hour. It's just cranking, boy. And I got that little TV, and I'm thinking, oh, I can't do this. Oh, I just had so much anxiety. My wife was there, and I'd say, I got all this anxiety, and then I'd pass out. Then I'd come to. And I kept doing that. Finally, I told that nurse, she left, and I finally told her, I got to get up and walk. He said, you can't walk. You just had surgery. I said, I don't care. I got to walk. I got to do something. So he said, okay, we took everything off my legs, and they let me dangle my legs over the bed, and I sat there for a while. And then what that guy told me went through my head. Don't be a cowboy. I say, give me something. I got to have something to relax me. He goes, what do you want? I said, give me some Valium. He goes, let's try some Benadryl. Benadryl? You can get that over the counter. I don't want Benadryl. I want Valium. He says, well, what do you take now? I said, what do I take now? At night, you mean? He goes, yeah. I said, nothing. He said, well, let's try the Benadryl. Okay, let's try the Benadryl. He gave me that Benadryl, knocked me right out. You know, my veins are so bad in my arms that during the night I could feel that IV that they had in me had blown. My arm gets about that big whenever they do that. But anyway, they brought all these nurses in the next day, and they're trying to get veins, and they finally got a vein. And then that afternoon they came to me and they go, would you like any morphine before we pull your IV out? I said, have I had any morphine? They go, nope. I said, I didn't have any morphine in the recovery room. She goes, nope. I had this drug called Toradol. It's like an ibuprofen product. I said, really? I said, I haven't had any morphine. They says, nope. I said, then I don't want any. The guy next door to me goes, I want his morphine. Give me his morphine. So I thought, boy, isn't that amazing? I go through a whole surgery and I ain't even had no morphine. So, and what was really nice is that I know that people in AA would have, if I'd have been here, would have came to the hospital. But down there, you know, down at UCLA, there was none. But some people from San Fernando Valley came down and spent time with my wife while I was in getting operated on in that. But I left that hospital, and I remember. She wouldn't let me drive home. I had a catheter in me. I took her home, dropped her off, put her in bed, and then I went to a meeting. And I remember sitting in that meeting thinking, boy, I'm glad to be here. But when I was going through all that, I remember when I was down at UCLA and they kept running tests on me to see if the cancer had spread and all that. And sometimes I'd feel sorry for myself or I'd get really afraid. And I was sitting there and this little girl walked out. She was all crippled and she had a big smile on her face. And I don't know, I just got a real sense of gratitude over me. And that kind of felt to me like a third step. Like that's what a third step would feel like. Because from that point on for a while, it went away after a while, but from that point, I felt like I was like in God's hands or something. I don't really know how to explain it. I just felt like he was carrying me and that, you know, no matter what happens, I thought, when I looked at her, I thought, you have no reason to complain. You've had a good life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Look what you've gotten in your life. If it ended today, you know, not that I wanted it to, but if it did, you've had a good run. And I just felt really calmed and really relaxed about everything. And I just kind of let go. See, that's my problem. My real problem is I don't know how to let go. God will do everything, and it probably already has. I just have the inability to be able to let go. When I was new, I used to think, God, I'm going to die before I could let go. I have so much going on. But eventually when I get to a point where I can just say, you know what, everything is just the way it is. I got back from there, and I'd worked on a job for 12 years. And I worked on that job. I started out as a clerk. And really, I started out at Lake Mead and Las Vegas Boulevard at 7-Eleven. And then I got hired from there to the store that I worked in. And I started out as a clerk. I became a manager. I became a general manager. And then I got my gaming control approval, and I became like a part owner, right? And I remember doing all that, and I went back to work. And I'd been there about, I don't know, a week or two. And I thought, you know, through all that stuff that I went through, I thought, life's too short to be here. Way, way too short to be here. And I thought, you know what, I don't want to be here anymore. I just don't. I don't want to be here anymore. And, you know, the problem with me is that you get me in a bad situation, I usually will stay in a bad situation because I don't have what it takes to leave the situation. And what I'm really going to do is I'm going to build a case against you so that eventually you look so bad to me that I can leave and feel okay about what I'm doing. You know, and what it really should be is you just look at a situation, this isn't good for me, I don't think I'll do it. But I can never do that. I'll stay in a bad situation till hell, who knows how hell freezes over, you know. And I remember leaving, and I left kind of on bad terms, so I went back and tried to clean it up a little bit, and I tried to stay 2 weeks, but my heart wasn't in it. I just couldn't stay there anymore. I just couldn't. And I remember that when I was going through that, I was having such a hard time, which I have a really hard time with my temper anyway, that my boss decided he wanted to send me to Dale Carnegie. And what Dale Carnegie taught me a lot of stuff there. One of the things they taught me, I know we hear it. People say if you're going to quit a job, then find another job before you quit the job, right? There they told me that if you want to quit a job, save up enough money for 6 months and then go look for another job, right? Well, I had gotten an inheritance and I gotten some money, so I had enough money. So I just had been to a point where I was so surrendered that I was willing to leave. And I left there, and I started doing what I do now. And I'll tell you, it's amazing how God will put people in your life. But at the same time that I did that, I changed sponsors too. And it wasn't that the sponsor I had at the time wasn't a good sponsor. Matter of fact, for the 12 years that I had that sponsor, I don't think anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous could have been a better sponsor. I really learned a lot from that person. And when I left there, because of everything that was going on, I just got another sponsor. Sometimes in life there's an impasse and you just can't get by it. And I went ahead and I got another sponsor and I did that. And then not too much longer after that, maybe a year or two. And by the way, you know, in that job, I've never regretted leaving it. I've never looked back. I've never regretted it. But a couple of years, maybe it was a year after that, I'm sitting there laying in bed watching TV and my wife's ironing, and she goes, I think I'm having a stroke. I'm thinking, well, you're only 46. You know, how can you be having a stroke at 46? And she goes, I think I am. I says, okay. So we went down to the emergency room, and yeah, she did. She had a small stroke, and it took us a long time. We went to a lot of hospitals, and she kept having them, and she kept getting numbness, and couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. And we went down to UCLA, and one doctor spent 4 hours with her. They thought she had MS, and they couldn't find out what was wrong with her there. And then finally she told me, you know, she's pretty intuitive. She says, you know, I have a feeling that my answers are in Cleveland, in the Cleveland Clinic. So we went back there. That guy talked to her for 10 minutes and figured out what was wrong with her. And what was wrong with her is she has a disease that her mother had. It's a genetic disease. It's passed on from person to person, and it's a small vessel disease, and it's, you know, it's really bad. I mean, there's the you know, over time, it's not going to get any better, you know. And there's been a lot of times through that, you know, when somebody gets sick like that or gets different, you know, the relationship changes. And you know, when I first got married, I hadn't been married for a long time. And I there's days when I felt like somebody threw me in a cold bathtub. I mean, and then what I would do is I'd try to pick fights with her so I could leave, you know. And but she's had so much Al-Anon, she wouldn't let me do that. And it all came back to me, you know. And then I'd have to go back and apologize to her, you know. And I remember going to Dick Tucson, and I said, Dick, man, you know, I says, and he, you know, these guys, they tell you these little stories, right? He started telling me a story about him and Gladie, how him and Gladie got in a fight, and she went upstairs and got all her luggage and come downstairs with two suitcases, and she's standing in front of him, and she says to him, He goes, you know, this is you wanting to leave, not me wanting you to leave. And she dropped her suitcases and she started crying. And she goes, you know, this is what I've always done. And I thought, you know, that's true. So what he's telling me is I got to change my attitude. And, you know, you could tell somebody you apologize and you're sorry, but after a while it gets old if you keep doing it over and over, you know. And I remember going to my sponsor at that time, and I said, you know, I never thought about therapy, but maybe this is one of those times, because I've always had a violent temper, and I don't want to be that way anymore. I don't like the way it makes me feel. And, you know, I go back and apologize to her and say, you know, I apologize for doing this, but I can't tell you it's not going to happen again, because it probably is. I mean, for me to tell you it's not going to happen again, no, that's not realistic. I said, but I'll try not to have it happen again. And I remember talking to him about it, and I thought, you know what, the only thing I can really do is 6 and 7. And I started praying, I started asking God for help, and little by little it started to get better. But I remember when I first got married, though, it was so hard, and I remember going to Dick, and he says, you know, just be of service, just like you do at work. I says, at work? In AA? Now at home? I mean, everywhere I go, man? You know, he goes, yeah, just try being of service, just trying to be helpful. And you know what? It's true. In any situation, I don't know what to do, just be helpful, and everything works out. And I started doing that. And I'll tell you, I'm the kind of person that, you know, if something's screwed up or messed up, let's just work on it really hard and straighten it out, you know. And there's some things in life that just can't be done that way. You know, when it comes to physical things or health and all that stuff, it just can't be done. But through everything, no matter what goes on in my life, there's certain things that I do in my life every day. I go to a meeting every day. I pray every day. I got a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. I got people in AA around me all the time. I just have so much gratitude for the people that God has put into my life. I mean, I really do. I do certain things, and I do that every day. And because I really don't want to go back to where I came from. I really don't. I don't want to go back to that place. I ask God a lot of times, God, please do not let me. Please don't let me leave the Center of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, on Thursday nights I usually go to a juvenile prison, and I sit there, and maybe we can help some of them people in there, and maybe we can, but I know that we help ourselves when we go there. But I know that when I sit there and I listen to these kids that are 16, 17 years old. Now, these kids didn't, you know, I'm not saying that the reason they're the way they are is because of the families they come from, but they came from places where I never came from. I mean, their mom and dad were, you know, making meth in the kitchen, you know, like from when they were babies, and taught them how to do it. And, you know, they're gangbangers, and they're, you know, but I sit and I listen to their attitudes, and I think to myself so many times, how did I ever survive my character defects long enough to get to where I am now? Their attitudes, I mean, you just can't get through there. And I understand, because that's the same attitude I had my whole life. You're not going to tell me nothing. I know it all. You know, I really liked it, though. They started coming, a lot of them really started coming there a lot. And then when they found out what AA was about, you could see them kind of diminishing a little bit, you know. They realized they probably might want to have to do something when they get out of there. But it's really good that I go out there, and I really need to see that, because I forget that sometimes. You know, back of Bill's story, he talks about what spirituality is. He said it's a lot of hard work and a lot of self-sacrifice for others, for tough times ahead, because there are going to be tough times ahead. You know, I always thought that when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you got a green card and you got to zip through everything and nothing really is ever going to happen, you know. And it's not true. Things are going to happen in my life. But the nice part about it is that through all this process, God's going to put people in my life and things in my life to be able to get me through it. Because I remember when I got diagnosed with prostate cancer, there was a guy that I had sponsored for years that went back out again, and he came back, and he was calling me like 3 or 4 times a day. Just crazy. And I tell you, I got so connected talking to him every day. Matter of fact, when he finally got sober, I thought, man, I'd pay you to go back out again, man. That was, I mean, I just felt so good talking to you, man. But I thank God he's still sober, but I'll close by, there's another thing in Bill's book, and in the back of Bill's story. He said that many of us have found utopia, and I never really knew what utopia was, but it's supposed to be like a perfect world, and He said, many of us felt like coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, we found utopia. And he goes, it's right here and it's right now. And I'll tell you, I am just so glad to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks.